This is The Hindu on Books, a weekly podcast from India's national newspaper on the latest and the best from the world of literature.
Hello and welcome to The Hindu Books Podcast. I'm Nistula Hebbar, and I will be speaking to journalist Rashid Kidwai on his latest book, The House of Sindhias, a saga of power, politics, and intrigue. I reviewed this book for The Hindu, and as a political journalist, it is a fascinating read on a dynasty that has survived the Mughals, the British, and now the Gandhis. Welcome, Rashid, to this podcast. It was a lovely book. I had a great time reading it. I hope to have a good conversation with you this evening.
Thank you, Nistala. Thank you for your kind words. And I think more and more readers would perhaps read this book and decide whether your assessment is right or it's rather lavish.
Let's get to the questions right away, because there's one question that I want to ask you, which pertains to your journey in writing this book as a writer, rather than about the subject on which you've written. And, you know, this comes from the introduction that you wrote to the book, where you, kind of described the fact that you find it difficult, and it is a difficult job, in fact, to write on people who are still currently engaged in public life, who are engaged in fighting elections, et cetera, and how to negotiate a very delicate balancing act of not attracting, of course, court cases, etc., and also to be true to what you are writing. Could you kind of go into a little bit of that dilemma?
Yes, I think writing about living politician is a risky business, because our politicians are very thin-skinned when it comes to criticism. You praise them, they will be happy. And as a political reporter, political editor of The Hindu, I mean, you are aware of this. Perhaps every day you kind of face this challenge where any kind of criticism of a personality or his policies, you know, is not taken well. But that's a professional challenge that we political journalists face. And the point is, the key point here is that we tend to write about living politicians with a kind of with accountability and a commitment towards our readers, be it a book reader or newspaper readers, that things are not sensationalized, things are substantiated, and there is no personal swipe. So what they say it in Hindi, it's written from a sakshi bhav, in the sense that, you know, you look at the developments as someone who's slightly away, but witnessing everything unfolding. So you don't take sides. In the process, nothing comes across as black and white, but a lot of shade of gray. And that is something I actually quite enjoy doing that, Nistula.
Okay. Did you get any kind of blowback from the people that you've so far written about? I know you are a well-known, biographer of Congress President Sonia Gandhi. And of course, now the Sindhias, whom you've written about. Have you ever kind of got any reactions from them after the books have come out?
Yeah, I think I have got, I'm blessed with, lot of this thing that many people gave very positive feedback. Some, of course, didn't like. And there is no point, you know, coming into a lot of the details. But I think books actually give you a chance to make assessment, a kind of dispassionate assessment. Even if politicians or concerned subject that you have written about, they may not like it, but they look at, you know, the holistic picture. So thankfully, I am quite grateful to all those people that I have written about. And mind you, there's no dearth of them. If I talk about Congress Party, I think there's not a politician that I have not commented upon. But there is a lot of, you know, grace and tolerance towards criticism on that count. It was just that when I wrote about Sonia Gandhi, I wrote an independent biography of hers. When it was becoming, it was converted into a film, that there was some kind of, legal notice, etc. But so far, as a journalist, as a writer, as an author, I'm safe from any defamation so far in my 5 books that I've written.
Well, that's good to know. This book, now let's come to the subject of the book. You know, this book is, you start from the founder of the Sindhia dynasty, And you gave a short kind of potted history, so to speak, of the dynasty and how it negotiated their relationships with the Mughals within the Maratha Confederacy and the war of the first War of Independence, 1857, and through the freedom movement and post-independence. What are the ideological battles, do you think, that presented themselves to the Sindhias, which they successfully negotiated, looking at their success in democratic politics?
I think it's a fascinating story, their kind of ideological groundings, that shift, course correction, regrouping. It's quite, and it's a story of life. You know, there are many highs and there are many lows. It depends, of course, where do you see it. So when Sindhias started off, Sindhias were very kind of, you know, son of the soil kind of story. They didn't fancy themselves as Chandramukhi or Suryamukhi, you know, rulers or the representative of God on earth. Rather, they thought themselves to be very modest. And in the book, I've written several anecdotes also to substantiate what they felt. I think they, by and large, they remain as rulers, they remain very secular. For instance, when Madhav Rao Maharaj, the great grandson of that present Jyotiraditya Sindhya, when he was getting married for the second time, he realized that that marriage was taking place in month of Muharram, which for a section of Muslims, it's a month of mourning. In Gwalior, there was less than 6% Muslims, but as a ruler, he thought that this would not be proper. So he moves away and goes to, you know, 100 kilometers away in a village, and where the marriage is formalized. Remember, at that time, a king's marriage used to be a grand affair. So every person had to be, you know, party to that feast and festivities and celebrations. So this is a kind of, you know, sensitivity they had. The Sindhias are a great believer in a Mansur Shah, a Sufi saint. They think that because of his blessings that they have achieved so much, not only the past, but present and maybe in future. So every time there is a Urs, that celebrations of that Mansur Shah in Gwalior, whether it was late Mother of Sindhia or at present Jyotiraditya Sindhia, they make it a point to attend it. So there are a lot of traditions are there. When Rajmata enters, you know, Sindhia family, she was one person who had, I would say, that kind of right-wing leaning. She didn't think much of Mahatma Gandhi and Congress Party and that whole thing about non-violence. And she thought that what Subhash Chandra Bose wanted to do to gain freedom from the British, that was a correct course. What Chandrasekhar Azad or Bhagat Singh wanted. So she was a bit of a rebel, and I think she fashioned her politics, post-independent India politics, in that manner. So the Sindhias' ideological, this thing is not being, it's a, you know, I mean, continuity with change. So wherever kind of situation demanded, they have adopted. And I think instead of making a value judgment of that, you know, a reading tells you how and why they've been so successful.
And politicians need to be sensitive to the voices on the ground, I suppose, and they have to respond to how people also change over time. Well, as someone who is also reported extensively on Madhya Pradesh, you in fact live in Bhopal, how do you view this ideological negotiation versus family ties in this family?
I think this has been a little difficult terrain, but they have negotiated electorally in very successful terms, because this is, here is a family which has been in power since 1731. I don't think, Nistula, if you look at you know, all over, perhaps in the entire world, you will have a family which has been so successful in monarchy. Of course, there have been many people who are, you know, whose kind of the rule has gone beyond, you know, centuries and all, more than three centuries. But they did succeed in converting themselves as, you know, democratically elected representatives. So the post-independent, at the time of independence, the Sindhia ruler, Jivaji Rao Sindhia, he becomes Rajya Pramukh, which was equivalent to at present a governor.
First Indian ruler, big ruler, in fact, to sign the instrument of accession.
Precisely. Okay. So they negotiated. You see, most of this Rajwadas or princely states, they fell on the wayside in negotiating that or integration of, in the
Indian
Union.
Possibly they didn't recognize how the ground had shifted from under them.
Precisely. The Sindhias were very deft. They donated a lot of money. They gave it from their personal thing, over 17 crores or so from official, that state coffers. They gave over 5 crores to, mind you, these are the big figures in the post-independent India when Jawaharlal. Government headed by Jawaharlal Nehru was desperately looking for resources and money. And then Jawaharlal Nehru summons Rajmata Sindhia. Actually, he had summoned Jivaji Rao Sindhia, but Rajmata goes. And then he says that, why don't you contest from on the Congress ticket? So 57 and 62, two Lok Sabha elections, Rajmata contests as a Congress nominee and wins. And then she becomes part of that Swatantra Party, which was
Rajaji's party.
Yeah, Rajaji's party as an anti-Nehruvian, focus on socialism, etc. And then she joins Bharatiya Jansang. And then she becomes a founder of BJP, present day BJP, which was formed in 1980. And her son, Madhav Sindhia, who had studied in Oxford and was very liberal in his outlook, he, even he won because when in 1971, when elections took place, young Madhav Sindhia was quite unhappy with Indira Gandhi because of abolition of private persons, etc. So he contests as a Jansang supported MLA, MP. And he wins that election. But when by 1977, Sindhia joins that Congress and he becomes a supporter. And he used to tell me also, I had a honor of interacting with him as a reporter on many occasions. And he said, yaar, ye mujhe that kind of, the BJP sort of, or Jansang's that narrow outlook. According to him, the narrow outlook, doesn't suit his temperament. He thought that he's a liberal person and he's to relish that. So this kind of flexibility, and yet they remain quite relevant. Mind you, Madhav Sindhia was a very important man. He was, a lot of reforms we have seen in Indian railways or in civil aviation, that open skies policies, this Shatabdis and electronic, this kind of passenger list, etc. It's all been his ideas. The old time, the reservation chart in trains used to be, many time it was in Hindi, and many people who were not very well versed with Hindi, it was very difficult for them. So he got a lot of reforms in place.
Hmm. And what about family ties? This negotiation, the changes in ideology, moving from one party to the other, mother and son on opposite sides. You have written quite a bit on what happened to their relationship and, the aides and associates who came in the middle, etc., etc. Do you think that the Rajmata Vijayaraje and late Madhav Sindhia were reconciled, towards the end?
Yes, I think I'll answer to the beginning of the question. I think politics took, very heavy toll on Sindhia's personal ties, and this is a very, I would say, a bit of a tragedy for them, as they say that, kingship knows no kinship, and there was a lot of, bad blood. They were not in talking terms. Rajmata Sindhia wrote a will that, which was fortunately, which was revealed after 13 days, that Madhav Sindhia should not be allowed to let her funeral pyre, and all, and a lot of things were there, and they used to openly attack each other. And that was a very unfortunate part of that mother and son relations. But I think towards the end, Rajmata Sindhia died in January 2001. And I think a few months before, when she was not well, she was ailing, she was hospitalized in Delhi's Apollo Hospital, Madhav Sindhia would go sit by her side, hold her hand, and recite Hanuman Chalisa. And according to Vasundhara Raje and Yashodhara Raje, who were present there, it was very comforting for Rajmata. Rajmata's eyes would lit up, show signs of life every time Madhav Rao walked in. And they used to tease her that, when the daughters were always around, but it didn't bring that degree of happiness. So I think towards the end, Madhav Rao and Rajmata, they had become very thick. And after Rajmata's death, Madhav Rao became very close to his two sisters, who were the politically on the other side of the fence. Madhav Rao was in Congress and they were in the BJP. But there used to be a lot of family dinners and get-togethers. Unfortunately, again, the twist of destiny that on September 30th, 2001, barely, 9 months after Rajmata's death, Madhav Sindhia also died in an air crash. So it was a big tragedy. I have interacted with all of them, and Madhav Sindhia's sisters, they call him Bhaiya, they still miss him greatly.
You also gave a very cute little anecdote in the book, which I especially liked, because whenever there was a conflict of interest in terms of family members competing with each other, whichever Sindhia would be campaigning in a particular area would just fold their hands and say, "Meri izzat rakh lena," which is a very enigmatic statement. So you said that the electorate used to be confused. And what is this person trying to tell us? Should we vote for their family member or should we vote for the party? That was quite interesting.
I must compliment you. You picked up a very on the book I have written in a very nuanced way, but I'll be in this podcast, I'll be very candid. See, what Sindhia used to do, they were very intelligent people, and they would issue an appeal from Mahal, from the palace, that, vote for a person who belongs to that palace, that whichever political side they were in. And they used to say that, vote for Mahal. So that was a kind of signal to the voters that vote for, if Madhav Rao was contesting as a Congress nominee, vote for him. If Rajmata Sindhia or Vasundhara or Yashodhara Raje Sindhia are fighting as BJP nominees, vote for them. And I think they did not campaign, but with the odd exception of 1984, when Madhav Rao Sindhia was pitted against Atal Bihari Vajpayee. Atal Bihari Vajpayee lost. At that time, Rajmata felt that it was her duty to support Atal Bihari Vajpayee, and to under when Narendra Modi's era came in 2014 and 19, then also the one Sindhia was expected to campaign against another Sindhia. There was no going back. So, but the Sindhias used their past, the kind of glory and that kind of affection, the kind of authority they had in that Gwalior region, in a very intelligent way. They would say that we are a Jan Sevak, we are people's representative, or modest workers. But a certain message would go with the entire ecosystem that vote for that palace. So no Sindhia, barring I think Vasundhara lost once from Bhind, and other time of course Madhav Jyotiraditya Sindhia lost in 2019. But generally the electoral record of Sindhias in Madhya Pradesh, in their erstwhile, empire, remain intact. They always won.
Well, there are many Sindhias in this, the next generation. And you've also covered a lot of other political dynasties, etc. Indian politics is full of them. Do you have a comment on the nature of transfer of political legacy? Because that is always a very fascinating subject. How does the political legacy accrue to one family member and not to another? And what is the case with the Sindhias, where all of them have had electoral success?
I think at one level, this dynasty culture and democracy, they don't gel. This is a very antithesis of it. But in Indian context, it has made a lot of impact. And I would say there are many positive aspects of this dynasty culture, no matter how reprehensible it may sound. Look at representation of, women in parliament. Nisula, you've been covering parliament for, a couple of decades now. And you may have seen that many of these women representatives are actually, they come from these, dynasties.
No, but and my question is not so much about women representation and what is good about a dynasty, but about, say, how do you pass on your particular political legacy or your qualities for which people love you to a particular member of your family and not to the other, like the Paswan family? There is a fight for a political legacy which is going on currently. Does it go to the son or does it go to the brother? So, how do you kind of...
So I was coming to it. First, I wanted to compliment some of these dynasties of providing better representation to women. To your question, this is very interesting, and that's something that you see that how political communication takes place. Political communication doesn't take place in through the social media, much hype social media. I may be from old school, and I've seen that how politicians, particularly this dynasty, they use their, you know, young children when they are campaigning. You know, Jyotiraditya would take his son for campaigning, and if Jyotiraditya Sindhya is going on the eastern side of, say, Gwalior town, his son would go on the western side of this thing, and they will just not do anything. Will just make themselves, you know, visible and do the small act, etc. And that really helps because it establishes, you know, some kind of imprint in voters' mind. And voters actually, they decide. They knew that, you know, for instance, Indira Gandhi's legacy was with Rajiv Gandhi, Sonia Gandhi, Rahul Gandhi, Priyanka Gandhi. Not so much with Menaka, because Menaka fell out with Indira Gandhi. She fought election, but she was seen as someone who's not, in spite of being, you know, Bahu and Indira Gandhi had spent a lot of good time with her. Sanjay Gandhi was very fond of her. But somehow, the Congress-minded voter, you know, rejected. So we see that when there is more than one family member in the fray and sometime on the opposite side of the fence, voters tend to go with the established leadership. And they do it. So that's what I'm saying. That's where some kind of silent
communication. You have the Thackerays, you know, you also have the Thackerays, the cousins.
Thackerays. You look at Raj Thackeray, I mean, he was flamboyant. A lot of people thought that, you know, that Bhatija, that, you know, nephew has more potential
he
than the son.
He also looked like a very young Bal Thackeray, actually.
Precisely, but the sun is rising. So I'm saying that somewhere, you see, there is a course correction. And mind you, there is a whole ecosystem. There are thousands of people who, I mean, political activists, you know, the fundraisers, the resource people, that kind of propagandists, all of them. So that ecosystem also helps establish that. You know, politics in India is very complex. So that messaging that takes place, it's very layered. So many people, you know, spread that word around, and somehow voters are convinced. So they tend to take, you know, very right call. You look at what happened when this Janaki Ramachandran tried to, you know, take control of ADMK after the death of MGR, and her political party was, you know, nowhere. It was, people could sense it that, you know, it's Jayalalitha who has inherited the political legacy of MGR. Similarly, you know, Lakshmi Parvati tried to represent NTR's legacy in Andhra politics, but it didn't happen. It's the bubble that, you know, went away. So I'm saying that actually there should be a book on this, how, you know, voters crack this, or how, you know, a member of a dynasty is more successful than the other.
Well, the Sindhya family is full of very strong leaders, you know, former chief ministers, you know, establishers of political parties, union ministers, state ministers, etc., etc. According to you, I mean, this is a very personal question, who do you think is the most fascinating Sindhia among them all?
I think if you're talking about present
your
lot,
your choice.
I think the present lot, I think I find Vasundhara Raje most fascinating. There was a lady who, you know, was married young, marriage was not successful, and yet she parked herself in Rajasthan. And mind you, Rajasthan is one, you know, state, and the many Indian states, unfortunately, where, you know, it is far more difficult for a, you know, woman politician to make the cut. There is some kind of, you know, some certain traditions are there. Then she went against the tide and as a commoner, and she fought a very heroic battle within the BJP. Mind you, it was not an easy thing. It was not enough for her to be Rajmata's daughter. There were many towering leaders were there. Bhairo Singh Shekhawat was there. Jaswant Singh was there. I mean, I can go on naming those politicians. And she found her place. And, you know, she would not use AC. She would travel a lot. She would be, you know, using all kind of tricks in the trade. A lot of hard work. It was not just 1 hour of performance. I mean, if you're for days together, you're traveling, you're doing padyatra, you're meeting people, you're going to villages and spending time eating with them, you know, picking a young toddler in your arms. I think it was all very genuine. And so that's how I'm saying she has fought it in a very hard way. I think Mother Rao, it came on a platter. Jyotiraditya also benefited from the family legacy. But, you know, Vasundhara, and mind you know, perhaps better than me, she is still, I mean, fighting in a very valiant manner.
Mm-hmm. That is true. That much we know after having covered BJP for so many years. Well, Rashid, this was a fascinating conversation. We've already almost clocked like 25 minutes. I don't know where the time has gone. For the rest of it, people who have sat through this podcast, this interview, do pick up the book. And I would really like to thank you, Rashid, for this lovely conversation. And I hope your book does well. I know every author wants to hear that. And I hope your book does really well. And that will be all from our side in today's podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Hindu on Books. You can now find The Hindu's podcasts such as In Focus and Parlay on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other major platforms. Write to us with comments and feedback at socmed4@thehindu.co.in.